Ladies and gentlemen, please rise for the playing of our national anthem.
Baseball fans, you're listening to Fabes Babes. Hello.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Matt, welcome to episode 12. Thanks for being here tonight.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. We're really excited to kick this off. So, good evening to Babes Babes friends. And thank you to all of you who are tuning in for our 12th episode. This episode is special for a few reasons. First off, it's our first live stream. So we'll see how this goes. And we're hoping that it'll entice more listener engagement. And secondly, and more importantly, we have a very special guest joining us tonight from one of the most sacred baseball grounds that exists, the home of the Boston Red Sox, Fenway Park. Matt Delaney is a Fenway Park tour guide in his sixth season working for the Boston Red Sox. In his six seasons, he has received numerous accolades for his contributions, providing high quality fan engagement. I can personally attest to this as I was one of Matt's lucky tour participants back in early June, which led me to cornering him at the end of the tour to make his request. Through his position, Matt has also been featured, or outside of his position, he's also been featured on the History Channel's Pawn Stars. Outside of Fenway, he is a sixth grade social studies teacher for the Medford Public Schools in Medford, Mass. And with that, Matt, welcome. Thank you for being here. And I'm going to pass it off to Kelsey for what we call around the horn.
Yeah. All right, Matt, we got to really officially break you in and welcome you to Babes Babes now. We're going to go around the horn. Nobody knows, but I've got a special question cooked up just for you. And actually tonight, it's going to be a little bit different for you and for Jonna, because you come from very different fan bases, and it just wouldn't have been fair to ask you both the same question. And that'll make sense as I get into it here. So Jonna, I'm going to ask you first, but I'll pose both questions here. So Matt, you can start thinking about it. I want to hear who Jonna's favorite Red Sox player is, or like a player that is, you know, known for playing with the Red Sox that she is willing to admit she might be particularly fond of. And Matt, on the other side, I would like you to tell us an iconic Yankees player that you would be willing to admit you might just be a fan of. And then I'll kind of round it out because, you know, I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan. And while we may not have the rivalry that the Red Sox and the Yankees have, we have been hurt by the Red Sox a few times in too recent memory for me. So, Jonna, would you be so gracious as to talk about what you might like about the Red Sox, who you might like with the Red Sox?
I will do it. Yes. My favorite Red Sox player is any player that was traded later on to the Yankees.
Well, that's a pop out.
Just kidding. I know. I actually do have a favorite one. But I do have to slide in a funny little like Yankees Red Sox tie here. So shortly after I completed the tour with Matt, I was down in the museum there at Fenway, and I noticed the display that you guys have for Wade Boggs. So of course I tweeted him, and I think I just captioned it "Better in pinstripes," and he liked it. Like we do interact sometimes on Twitter, so I had to do that. But anyway, no, my favorite tried and true 14-year-long Red Sox player, and I would imagine to this day, this is what the Twins consider to be their biggest loss of all time, His jersey was buried in Yankee Stadium by a construction worker during the building of the current stadium, David Ortiz, Big Poppy. I wasn't a huge fan of him when he was playing there, I don't recall, but, and I didn't like hate him, but I hated all Red Sox back then. but no, I really have come to appreciate him in his role at Fox, as an MLB studio analyst. And I think I've just come to know his character more there. And he's hilarious. He's insightful. And I love the dynamic that he has with A-Rod and Jeter and the guys. So Big Poppy for me.
Great answer. Great answer.
All right, Matt, have you had some time to come to terms with what you might be willing to admit here as a diehard Red Sox?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough, you know, as a diehard Red Sox fan growing up. You know, we always say the saying, we have two teams we root for, the Red Sox and whoever's playing the Yankees. And I'm sure Jonna has the same. It's just reversed for her, I bet. But, you know, my answer is going to be a little bit similar to hers. You know, both, I would have to say, you know, when Derek Jeter and A-Rod were both on the Yankees, you know, they were painted as supervillains for us Red Sox fans. But, you know, now that they have stepped away from the playing baseball, you know, and have stepped into that broadcasting role, I really have grown to respect, you know, what both of them have brought to the game. And, you know, Derek Jeter as the captain, A-Rod, and David Ortiz, you know, that good banter on Fox. And I think, you know, seeing them not, you know, hitting home runs over the fence, I've really been able to grow, you know, my respect and appreciation for what both of them have brought to the game. So I would say that would have to be my answer.
That makes sense, because they're you know, giving back to you a little bit instead of just taking away and like hurting players.
Yeah.
Well, I'll share with you, Matt, the one and only time that I've been in Boston. I know the one and only time that Jonna has been in Boston is when you two met recently. But the one and only time I have been in Boston was late October of 2013, when the St. Louis Cardinals and the Boston Red Sox were supposed to be playing Game 7 of the World Series. I was living in New York City at the time, and I took a bus down to meet my friends who were flying in from Central Illinois, and we were going to go to Game 7. It was going to be, I still to this day have not gone to a Cardinals playoff game. It was going to be my first Cardinals playoffs game. And instead, it was the day that the Boston Red Sox hosted their World Series parade. So I went anyway. We already had, you know, hotel booked, bus tickets bought. But for a Cardinals fan, it was, I mean, I still had a great time. Boston is a lovely city, but
it was
a brutal welcome to Boston for me.
Yeah.
That being said, I think the player that I always loved watching on the Boston Red Sox the most is probably Nomar Garciaparra. Mm. I was a huge fan of like Edgar Renteria and the infielders, but especially shortstops. So I was always really drawn to him and remember watching him, you know, on the ESPN web gems every night, practically every night. So
yeah, he was my favorite player growing up. Every kid, you know, perfected the wrapping the batting gloves up when they were playing the league, just like he did. I'm guilty as charged. He walks on water around here.
Yeah, you're like, that's just what you're supposed to do. That's how
That's
awesome. Well, thank you all for being such great sports, great baseball fans. And that was a really fun way to bring us all together and find some common ground here to kick it off.
Absolutely. Thank you. And Matt, if you're ready, we're just going to launch into the Fenway virtual tour.
Yeah, let's jump right in.
All right. So I'm just going to take Kelsey and I off the screen, and it'll be you, and we'll have some slides here.
All right. Perfect. All right. So welcome to Fenway Park, everyone. Again, my name's Matt. I've been a tour guide for 6 seasons. Love going to the ballpark every day, and I'm excited to come on in this podcast and share with you my favorite place to be. So let's dive right in. All right, so kind of just a brief history of Fenway overall. First of all, we're the oldest ballpark in all Major League Baseball. Opened our doors for the very first time on April 20th, 1912. second oldest ballpark is Wrigley Field, home of the Chicago Cubs. And then there's actually a massive gap between the second oldest and third oldest. Third oldest is actually Dodger Stadium, opened up in 1962. 30 ballparks scattered across Major League Baseball. Only seven remain that were built before 1990. So Fenway is just a gem. You don't see that much anymore. What you're looking at is Gate A. Gate A is the very first gate that opened up at Fenway Park. You would have purchased your ticket at Gate A, entered it. Ticket for opening day probably cost you around 49 cents to get into the ballpark. So a lot cheaper than today. But Fenway has pretty much stayed the same, that facade. That's all original brickwork from 1912. So we really take pride in keeping everything authentic and looking just like it was back in the 1910s. So that is kind of the front facade or front door of Fenway Park, if you could say. All right, why don't we move on to the next slide? All right, so we get two beautiful views of the ballpark here. The dimensions of the ballpark have been pretty consistent over the 111 years that Fenway has been in the city of Boston. So a little history to start us off. Boston Red Sox started playing professional baseball in Boston in 1901. But from 1901 until 1907, we were known as the Boston Americans because we helped created the American League. However, following year 1907, our owners, the Taylor family, they bought a uniform that had a red stock on it with the white words Boston, and then became the Boston Red Stockings, but then shortened the word Stockings to Socks with the S-O-X spelling to mirror the Chicago White Sox spelling, because it was easier to spell out Stockings on, it was easier to spell out Socks on newspapers than Stockings. Now, our first ballpark was the Huntington Avenue Baseball Grounds. That stadium no longer exists anymore. It's actually Northeastern University. However, in 1911, the Taylor family were actually looking to get out of baseball. And they realized they could get more money for the team if they sold it with a brand new stadium. So they bought land in Boston's Fenway neighborhood. And that is where we get the name from, the neighborhood. There's no Fenway family. Fenway comes from an old English term, the fens. And what does a fens mean? Swamp or marshland in today's English. So the Taylor family named the ballpark after the neighborhood. They started construction in Fenway September 1911. And on April 20th, 1912, Fenway opened its doors for the very first time, 5 days after the Titanic sank. So that just shows you how old we are. We've been around for quite some time. On that opening day, we played a team from New York. Their name was the New York Highlanders. We beat them 7-6 in extra innings. And we as Red Sox fans, and John, I might get a little upset about this part. We like to say that the Highlanders got so embarrassed that they lost to the Boston Red Sox on Fenway's opening day that they went back to New York. And the following year, they changed their name from the Highlanders to the Yankees. So us Sox fans love to say that we've been beating the Yankees here since day one. Now, the field you're looking at, it's the smallest active playing surface in about in Major League Baseball, at around 85,000 square feet. Average MLB playing surface is somewhere around 109,000, 110,000 square feet. So we have a small playing surface, and that's due in part to when the Taylor family bought the land to build Fenway, the five streets that surround Fenway. We have Brookline, we have Ipswich, Van Ness, Lansdowne, Jersey Street. They were here prior to the ballpark being built. So Fenway has never had the opportunity to expand outward. We can only expand up. So it's crucial that we use all the space we have at the ballpark to our advantage. Our current seating capacity, 37,535 fans. That puts us in the smaller range for seating capacity. Two ballparks seat fewer fans than us at the moment. They are Cleveland and Miami. We use real grass here at Fenway Park. We don't use AstroTurf or artificial turf. We use Kentucky bluegrass that's grown down in South Jersey. The warning track is actually not dirt. A lot of people think it's just boring old dirt. actually crushed up lava rocks that we import from Colorado. Helps with the drainage of traction, because remember, Fenway was built on swampland. So Fenway back in the 70s and 80s was very prone to flooding. And this summer especially, we've had about 10 to 15 inches of rain in the last 6 weeks or so. The Warner track has helped out tremendously with preventing the flooding. In the infield is a little secret blend of silt, sand, gravel, and clay, and some other secret ingredients the grounds crew doesn't like to discuss. Hardest working grounds crew in Major League Baseball. So that's kind of the early history of the team so far. So we'll keep moving on. Perfect. This is exactly where I'd like to go next. So 1910s, big decade for the Red Sox. Out of the first 15 World Series, we win five of them. 1903, the first ever World Series against the Pittsburgh Pirates. Cy Young helped us win that first ever World Series. 1912, 1915, 1916, 1918. But then we take our very famous 86-year break that we call it up here. Then we end our break in 2004, 2007, 2013, and most recent and ninth overall in 2018. Now, how we won a lot of those early World Series was back in 1914. We sent a couple scouts down to Baltimore, Maryland, to check out a highly talented young left-handed pitcher by the name of George Herman Root. But you might know him as the Babe, name of the podcast. So Babe Ruth was a pitcher for the Red Sox in his early career, but he soon transitioned into one of the best hitters baseball has ever seen. Now, 1919 is a historic season for Babe. In 1919, he hits 29 home runs for the Boston Red Sox. Now, why is that significant? The rest of the Red Sox in 1919 hit a combined total of 4 home runs. So Babe hits 29, rest of the team hits 4. Now, in 1919, Babe's making about $10,000 to play professional baseball for the Boston Red Sox. And after his historic season in 1919, he realizes, hey, I should get paid like the best player in baseball. So that offseason, he goes to our owner. Our owner's a young gentleman, Harry Frazee. And Babe lays his cards on the table and says, Harry, look what I can do for the team. I can do it all. I can pitch. I can hit. I can field. How about you double my salary to $20,000, which would have been unheard of to pay someone that amount of money to play professional baseball. That would have been more money than the president of the United States was making at that time period. Here's the thing, however. Babe and Harry were not the best of friends. Babe was a little bit of a party animal off the field. Harry didn't appreciate his off-the-field lifestyle and antics. And Harry said, Babe, I'm not going to give you a pay raise unless you clean up your act. Be a role model for the young players. Babe countered and said, I'm going to live my life the way I want to live it, Harry. If you don't give me a pay raise, I'm going to sit out the season. Harry counters and says, you know what, Babe? I'm done. So what does Harry do? He sells them to our arch rivals, the New York Yankees. Harry actually sells the team and ballpark in the early 20s to new ownership group. And the 1920s are some dark times for both the team and ballpark. 1920s, the Red Sox have 10 losing seasons. 7 of them dead last, 3 of them second to last. By 1926, Fenway Park has fallen apart. Tornado actually goes through Fenway, destroys some sections of seats. We have fires that destroy parts of the ballpark. So it is not looking good for the future of Fenway. Let's fast forward to 1933. Now, in 1933, there's a lot of talk that the Red Sox are going to get moved to another city and Fenway is going to get torn down. But everything changes that year when a gentleman out in Detroit, Michigan, turns 30 years old. And what does he get for his 30th birthday? Well, he comes into some money on his birthday. Comes into $40 million on his 30th birthday. Now, this gentleman had a name. Thomas Austin Yawkey was his name. Now, Tom came from a baseball family. His uncle was actually the owner of the Detroit Tigers, and Tom was raised by his uncle, and he wanted to be just like him when he grew up. So what does Tom do? Well, in the height of the Great Depression, Tom buys the only team at ballpark up for sale at that time, the Boston Red Sox in Fenway Park, for a record $1.2 million. He spends $1.5 million to make major renovations to the ballpark, and four of them are with us to this day, 89 years later. But I want to highlight our blue grandstand seats, which is the photo right over there. Now, our iconic blue grandstand seats are 89 years old. Those are the original oak and iron seats from 1934. They are the oldest seats in baseball and the only wooden seats left in Major League Baseball. And a lot of baseball fans like to say that they are the most uncomfortable seats in Major League Baseball because people were built a lot different back in the 1930s. Now, people ask us all the time, are you ever going to remove seats? What are you going to do? And we say we're keeping them. And our answer is one word, it's history, because generations of Red Sox fans have been sitting in these seats, passing tickets through their families. In 2012, we were added to the National Register of Historic Places, which means Fenway Park is a museum. Any changes the Red Sox want to make to Fenway, they have to prove that the changes won't impact the historical authenticity or architecture of this ballpark. So even if the Red Sox leave Fenway, which I hope they never do, we take pride in knowing that Fenway will be here no matter what happens. So if you're coming to Fenway soon and you've got grandstand seats, get ready to experience some history. So let's move on. All right. So arguably Mr. Yawkey's most famous feature is what Fenway's most famous for. It's our left field wall, but the nickname we have for it is the Green Monster. Now, why does Mr. Yawkey build a giant wall in left field? Well, back in the 1930s, when Tom Yawkey buys the team, Lansdowne Street, which is the street behind the wall today, was known as General Motors Way. It was home to car dealerships. Now, car windows and baseballs do not go together. So Mr. Yawkey soon realized this was going to be a major issue. So what does he do? Well, he overreacts a little bit. He builds the tallest wall in all of Major League Baseball to this day. It's 37 feet high, 2 inches tall. Then a few years later, he adds a 20-foot high net on top of the wall to prevent balls from crashing down onto the street and damaging the cars below. Now, the net stays up there from 1936 until 2002. Now, at the end of the 2002 season, the net is taken down. And one of the first major additions under the new ownership group led by John Henry, Tom Warner, and Larry Lucchino was to put seats on top of the wall. Now, since 2003, the Green Monster seats have been voted the best seats in all Major League Baseball. Now, for our first season back in 2003, we really didn't know the demand for the Green Monster seats. So we figured, why don't we price them like bleacher seats, right? They're just a little bit higher up than our normal bleachers. So we put every ticket for every game in 2003 on sale for $50. The entire 2003 season sold out in 72 minutes. People camped out overnight at Fenway Park in February just to get tickets for that first season, back when you actually had to come to Fenway Park to buy tickets instead of buying them on your phone like you can today. So everyone always asks, how much is it to sit up there? What the Red Sox do all over the ballpark for tickets is dynamic pricing. Seats all over Fenway depend on who we're playing, time of year, there's a special event, how well the Red Sox are doing, strength of schedule. All those factors go into consideration. Now, on the wall itself, there's 269 seats and 100 standing room tickets. Now, pricing can vary drastically. On cold April nights, you could get a front row ticket for around $150. But if you want to watch the Red Sox and Yankees play late August, early September, you're probably looking at $600, $700, maybe even $800 for a front row ticket. It's 2018 World Series Game 1 against the Los Angeles Dodgers. A ticket for a monster seat was going for $12,000 on the third-party app. Because, like I said, they're the best seats in all baseball. People who decide to sit up there, they're treated like royalty at Fenway Park. They're the only ones allowed up there during the games. Security checks their ticket. They give them a stamp. They get to come in half an hour earlier than everyone else to watch BP. They have their own concession stands, own bathrooms, and, of course, they have bragging rights. we always say, if you're up there for a game, bring a glove. Balls come up here around 100 miles an hour. I can trust you. It hurts to get hit by a ball because I've been hit by a bat in practice ball and left a nice bruise on my wrist for about 2 weeks, and I didn't even get the baseball. So bring a glove, or we say hide behind someone you don't like. Let them get hit, and then you can pick up the ball. So again, Green Monster seats have been voted the best seats in all of baseball. And we're going to move on. All right. So Fenway Park, probably have seen it in movies. So we'll start there. So Fenway Park has been featured in lots of movies. Just want to name a few. The Town. Fever Pitch, one of my all-time favorite baseball movies. The Catcher Was a Spy, Field of Dreams, Moneyball, just to name a few. The most recent movie to be filmed here was actually the newest Godzilla movie. So Fenway Park has a long storied history of being featured in Hollywood movies. Transition into music, Fenway Park also has a rich music history. We've actually had concerts here since the 1920s when we had John Philip Sousa and the United States Naval Band play at Fenway. Back in the 1970s, we had the New England Jazz Festival headlined by Ray Charles and B.B. King. But under the new ownership group, we started the Fenway Park Concert Series to attract big names to perform here. How we do concerts is the stage goes out in center field. We put white plastic sheet in all over the outfield grass to protect the grass from damage. We then put chairs out there so people can watch the concert from the field. Since 2003, we've had countless musicians and bands perform at Fenway Park. Just to name a few musicians who have performed here, Aerosmith, Dropkick Murphys, Backstreet Boys, Kane Brown, Luke Bryan, Red Hot Chili Peppers, The Rolling Stones. You name an artist musician, they have probably performed here at Fenway. Some groups that have performed here. We had Kane Brown and Dead & Company back in June. Last week, we actually had Pink in for two shows with Fall Out Boy. Next week, Morgan Wallen's coming in for three nights. Zac Brown Band for the record 16th time at Fenway Park, and Guns N' Roses. If you've never seen a concert at Fenway Park, highly recommend it. Back in 2021, I was able to see Billy Joel play at Fenway Park. He put a tremendous show on. Definitely a completely different atmosphere when compared to a ballpark. Just goes to show you, we use Fenway Park for lots of other events besides baseball. So we'll continue on. So I believe our next slide is going to be about Fenway Farms. There we go. So this is probably one of the coolest things or places that we have here at the ballpark. Now, Fenway Farms, excuse me, is our rooftop farm. And what we do up here is we grow fresh produce to use in our ballpark concession stands, luxury boxes at the ballpark. We grow somewhere between 5,000 to 6,000 pounds of fresh produce every year, harvest over 30 different styles of fruits, vegetables, herbs, and spices. Everything from chili peppers to sweet potatoes to strawberries to kale, eggplant, you name it, we have grown it. 2,400 square feet of growing space. Now, Fenway Farms is relatively new. It started back in 2015. It was actually the idea of Linda Henry, wife of principal owner John Henry, to make use of some wasted space. Prior to 2015, Fenway Farms was just a boring blacktop roof. So it's a great way to Red Sox use all the space they have here at the ballpark. Because like I said earlier, when the Taylor family bought the land to build Fenway Park, the five streets that surround Fenway were here prior to the ballpark being built. So we've never had the opportunity to expand outward. We can only expand up. So it's crucial that we use all the space that we have here at the ballpark. Red Sox use about 2/3 of the produce in-house. The remaining third we donate to local area food banks. So absolutely nothing goes to waste here at Fenway Farms. Very cool feature that a lot of people are surprised to see at a ballpark. And our next stop, we're going to go inside what we say is the best seats in baseball that you can't buy. It's the press box at Fenway Park. So your photo on your left. So the press box at Fenway Park, that's where written media sits and writes about the game. Now there's four rows in total. You can kind of see two rows there, but there's two more rows up in the back. And it's all assigned seats in there. The first two rows are reserved exclusively for members of the National Baseball Writers Association of America. Those are the folks who get to vote on the end of the year awards, such as Rookie of the Year, MVP, Cy Young, and they get to vote on who's enshrined in the National Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. We have a third row up above for small-time media who are just starting their careers out. And then in 2007, we actually had to add a fourth row in the press box because in 2007, we signed two pitchers from Japan, Hideki Okajima and Daisuke Matsuzaka. And because we were getting so many media requests from Japan to follow those two Japanese superstars, we had to build a fourth row just for Japanese media back in 2007. Today, that's kind of used as an overflow media area and when we have large amounts of international media come big and to sit up there. Now, the home sports writers in this first row, they have a very important job before every game. Those windows in front of the first row, the sports writers, they get to decide, are the windows open for a game or are they closed for a game? But here's the catch. Whatever they vote on in the top of the first has to stay like that for the entire game. It's a ground rule. Whatever the windows are at the start of the game, they have to stay like that for the whole game. Meaning if the windows are open in the top of the first, the sports writers in the first row cannot close them halfway through the fifth inning. The windows are open and severe weather comes, they can shut them then. We simply don't want the windows being open and closed at the leisure of the sports writers because it'd be distracting for the players out on the field. So if these windows are open like they are right now, like they are on a nice summer night, foul balls do come up there from time to time at about 100 miles an hour. If they're closed like they are in that photo, that's shatterproof glass. Balls simply bounce off the glass and roll down into the net below for a souvenir for a fan. So that's the press box. Best seats in baseball you can't buy because you have to be a member of the media to have access to that area. Photo on your right, that's just some of our luxury boxes seats. So on our third level, same level as the Green Monster, we have our luxury boxes that are usually rented out by companies. Each box has its own bathroom and kitchenette, and then they have padded seats in front of their box so that they can watch the game from. So that just goes to show you how Fenway Park, we try to use all the space we have here. Because there was a time period when we didn't really have a lot of luxury boxes. A lot of the luxury boxes came after our new ownership group bought the team in 2002. So we're going to continue on our tour. And our next stop is going to be the Green Monster wall, specifically the scoreboard. Now, the scoreboard is the oldest manually operated scoreboard in all of Major League Baseball. Now, three people have the dream job of working inside there during a game, but it is not a dream for working conditions. Why? Because it is 1934 inside the wall. What do I mean by that? Inside the Green Monster, there's no heat. There's no air conditioning. There's no running water in there, which means there's no bathroom in there. So we don't really know what happened to Manny Ramirez when he would go inside the wall during the games. During commercial breaks, what happens in the wall stays inside the wall. We did give the people who work in there some amenities. We gave them a mini fridge, microwave, series of fans, and we gave them Wi-Fi access so that they can follow out-of-town scores. Three of them are working in there during a game. One person's in charge of Fenway Park score. One person's in charge of an American League score, and the last person's in charge of the National League score. And the National League score has the toughest job out of all three. Why? Well, once you get past where it says American League, a giant support pole blocks your path to the National League scores. So the National League scorer in between innings during commercial breaks has to update the National League scores on the field. He carries the hand-painted tin tiles that weigh 3 to 5 pounds, and he has to run out onto the field through a door on the field, run down to the National League scores, update that, and it usually lasts in about 2 minutes because that's the length of a commercial break. Sometimes he gets an added 30 seconds when we're on national television because commercials are a little bit longer on national TV. And that's a cool feature that we have at the scoreboard that you will only see when you're at a game. So next time you come to Fenway, make sure in between commercial breaks during the innings when the teams are switching who's hitting whose field, and watch the scorer come out and update those out-of-town scores. Now, my favorite fact about Fenway Park relates to the scoreboard, and there's a secret message on the scoreboard, so I want to turn your attention to the photo on the right. Now, I've talked about Tom Yawkey, and haven't mentioned his wife, Jean Yawkey. Now, the Yawkeys owned the Red Sox from 1933 when Tom buys the pair all the way until 1992 when Jean passes away. Now, the Yawkeys had no problem with money. They were very wealthy people. However, they were very humble with their money. They had every chance to rename this place after themselves. They did not. They actually donated a lot of their money to help fund hospitals and all that around the Boston area. But they also had no children. They had no one to pass the team and ballpark to when they died. But they wanted to leave their mark on Fenway for generations of Sox fans to come and admire. So they came up with the idea to leave their initials on the scoreboard, but not in English, in International Morse code. So they decided to leave them on the scoreboard. To find Tom's initials, if you look where it says American League, right below the N in American, between an R and a P, you'll see the initials of Thomas Austin Yawkey in Morse code. Gene Remington Yawkey in International Morse code. To find Tom's initials, go right to the left between the E and the P in the Fenway Park box score, and you'll see the exact same thing. That's Thomas Austin Yawkey in Morse code. And this is the only in-play memorial in baseball. And the really cool thing about this, people who've lived in Boston all their life and Red Sox fans all their life to this day have no idea those initials are there. I'm 28 years old. I grew up just outside Boston, lived here all my life. I had no idea those initials were there until I started working here back in 2018. So that's probably my favorite fact about Fenway Park that I love sharing with people who have lived here all their life. All right, we're going to continue on. All right, so every MLB stadium has two foul poles, but ours are unique. Our right field foul pole, which is the photos you are seeing here, this is known as a pesky pole. It's the shortest distance in Major League Baseball to hit a home run at 302 feet down the right field line. Named after Johnny Pesky. Now, John Pesky was an infielder for the Red Sox back in the 40s and 50s. And when his playing career was done, he actually stayed with the franchise for over 60 years. Player, coach, manager, broadcaster, scout, ambassador. There's even rumors Johnny cut the grass, sold peanuts, and cleaned toilets, just as they did every job at Fenway Park. That's why he got the nickname Mr. Red Sox, since he was with this organization for so long. Now, Johnny Pesky was not a home run hitter. He only hit 17 career home runs, 9 of them at Fenway Park. So one of his teammates during his playing career was Mel Parnell. And Mel Parnell was a pitcher who then, when retired, went into broadcasting. And Mel would see these home runs that would be hit around that right field foul pole. And Mel would comment, you know, those home runs shouldn't count. Those are pesky shots since it's so short. And an ode to one of his friends playing Johnny Pesky. So that's where the moniker Pesky Pole came from. It was informally known as the Pesky Pole until 2006. When we retired Johnny's number 6 on our right field retired numbers. And then we officially christened it as the Pesky Pole in honor of everything Johnny did for his for this organization. He was active until the day he died in 2012. We miss him dearly. It's always a tradition for people to go over the right field and sign their name on the pesky pole. I did it when I was about 6 years old. However, they paint it pretty much every offseason. So I think my name's been painted over long ago. So that, again, is the pesky pole in right field. So we'll continue on. So the most famous seat in all of Fenway Park is there's one lone red seat out in our bleacher section. And that red seat marks the longest home run hit in the history of Fenway Park. It is 502 feet from home plate. And there's a story of why we know it was hit that far. June 9th, 1946, the Red Sox are playing a day game doubleheader against the Detroit Tigers. Why are we playing a doubleheader? Well, back in 1946, the Red Sox didn't have light towers. So they had to play day game doubleheaders to get all of their games in. They didn't get light towers until 1947. Now, in this seat, there is a gentleman from New York. His name is Joseph Boucher. He is a businessman in town and decided to skip work that day to catch the games. Now, back then, you bought the seat for admission. So one ticket got you two games. And going to the ballpark in the 1940s was a big social event. You wanted to look your best. So ladies would be wearing long, elegant dresses, and guys would be wearing suits and probably a nice hat. So Mr. Boucher makes his way to Fenway Park, finds his seat, makes it through the first game, no problem. Now, he's also brought along with him a straw hat to shield himself from the hot sun. The sun rises behind the bleachers and sets behind the press box. So day games, our bleacher section gets full sun. Now, he makes it through the first game with no issues. During this time period, there's an intermission between the first and second game. And according to Mr. Boucher's family, he thought this was a great opportunity to catch up on some much-needed sleep. So Mr. Boucher, he pulls his straw hat over his eyes and decides to take a little nap. However, he passes out and he misses the start of the second game. Bottom of the first of the second game, Fred Hutchinson, the pitcher for the Detroit Tigers, tries to sneak an 83-mile-an-hour changeup by arguably the greatest player in Red Sox history, Ted Williams. That was the wrong move because Ted Williams loves hitting the changeup. He hits that pitch and it goes all the way back to right field. It's going, it's going, it's going, and it hits Mr. Boucher right in the head. It hits him with such force, it punches a hole right through the straw hat that he's wearing. The ball bounces off his head, and to this day, no one knows where that baseball is. It's been lost to history. Mr. Boucher survives, lives a long, happy life, probably would have a concussion in today's medical terms. Reporters run out to him, and they start to ask him question after question. However, Mr. Boucher says, stop. I want to say something. How far does one have to sit at this ballpark to be safe? And the answer to this day is 503 feet because no one has hit a ball further than intersection 42, row 37, seat 21. No one has come close to hitting that red seat. David Ortiz will sometimes come out a little bit early in batting practice with an aluminum bat trying to hit that red seat. He still came nowhere close. He was famously quoted as saying, they keep moving that red seat further and further back. I'm never going to be able to hit it. Following day, Mr. Boucher's on the front page of the Boston Globe, June 10th, poking his hand through the hole that the ball made in the caption underneath that photo, bullseye. Anyone can sit in that red seat. It's not a season ticket. It's not left open, not reserved or anything. You just call up the ticket office and say, hey, I want the red seat, and they'll know exactly which one you're talking about. It's about the same price as all the other seats out there, $30, $40, $50. It's only been empty twice in its history. July 5th, 2002, Ted Williams passed away. So for the remainder of that season, we put a black armband around the red seat. A security guard sat next to it for every home game. Fresh flowers were put there as well to honor the life of Ted Williams. It was emptied on June 9th, 2006, the 60th anniversary of Mr. Boucher getting hit in the head. We invited his family for the game that day. Unfortunately, Mr. Boucher had long passed by then. So what did his family do to honor him? Well, they rented out that whole row, all wore straw hats, and left the red seat open to honor Joe. So that's the story of the one lone red seat. It's always a fan favorite. When gates open, you always see people go out there to take a picture next to that red seat. All right, I'm going to move on. So I believe this is our last slide. So on our tours, we finished in the Royal Rooters Club. Now, the Royal Rooters Club is our season ticket holders club. Named after the first fan base of the Boston Americans, and we have lots of cool items on display here. I want to highlight three items that you see here. In the top left, those are old seats, believe it or not, from when Fenway first opened back in 1912. Seats have come a long way since then. In the top right, that is actually a glove that Babe Ruth used during his time with the Boston Red Sox. Now, Babe was a lefty. They didn't make left-handed gloves back then when he was playing, so he actually had to use a right-hander's glove. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, we have autographed baseballs from every team that's won the World Series from 1920 going up until 2020. Collection recently valued at $8.2 million. Our Royal Rooters Club is our season ticket holders club, so they pay an additional fee to have access to that private membership club. We also have Hall of Fame bats from members of the Red Sox who have won World Series on display there. We have memorabilia from all of our retired numbers, such as number 9, Ted Williams. It's just a cool area that we like to end the tour in, because, you know, once game starts, a lot of people don't have the opportunity to go into our Royal Rooters Club. All right. Believe we're going to move on. So congrats. You just completed a Fenway Park virtual tour. So want to thank the Babes Babes for letting me have the opportunity to do this, and the Red Sox for approving me to come out and share my passion for this beautiful ballpark. There is a link down there where you can book tours. We do tours 7 days a week, and we do it during the wintertime, summertime, spring, fall. So come on out to America's most beloved ballpark. I'll be there, and we hope to see you soon. So thanks for letting me share a part of my favorite place with you all.
You're on mute, Jonna, but that was so awesome. That's what she's saying.
This is an amateur mistake. This is our first. I did warn you all. This is our first night on StreamYard. So, but yes, that was incredible. Thank you so much. Like, even though I've been through the tour and remembered so much of it, there's still, you know, details that were new to me or I didn't remember. So thank
you. Yeah, that made me even more excited to see it in person as well. So that was a great sneak peek.
Yeah, thank you.
We got a couple questions in the chat for you when you were walking us through. So yeah, we've got a couple more things to ask you if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure, totally.
Eric posed a really interesting question, which I would love to know more about too. And I know a little bit of the background of Wrigley on this because I live in Chicago. So I'm interested to see if there's similarities with that. But besides its charm, what has kept the Red Sox playing at Fenway Park despite, you know, teams building new stadiums? And obviously they have a limited capacity because of it as well.
It's just the history. You know, Fenway Park has been with Boston for over 111 years. And actually in 1992, when Jean Yawkey passes away, she transferred ownership of the team at ballpark to the Yawkey Family Trust. In the mid-1990s, the trust was managed by a gentleman by the name of John Harrington. And he did like a study, a feasibility study of Fenway Park. And the study came back and it said, Fenway Park too old, too inadequate. It would cost more money to renovate it than to just build a brand new ballpark. So he drew up plans to build a brand new ballpark. He presented them to the city of Boston. And let's just say Bostonians were not happy about that idea. There was a Save Fenway movement, bumper stickers, T-shirts, flags. Wow. There was so much public uproar that John Harrington realized he could not go through with his plan. So he only had one option, was to put the team and ballpark up for sale. Seven groups bidded for the Boston Red Sox and Fenway Park in the early 2000s. Six of them were going to tear down Fenway Park, build a brand new stadium. But only one group, led by John Henry, Larry Lucchino, and Tom Warner, were committed to preserving Fenway Park. They ultimately ended up purchasing the team and ballpark for about $665 million, and they've put over $500 million into preserving Fenway Park. So Fenway, we're not going anywhere anytime soon, and we love it like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I've witnessed some of the challenges that Wrigley Field has, you know, trying to make necessary updates and stuff like that. And I know part of their challenge too of like just ripping it down and starting anew is the fact that it's in the middle of a neighborhood in a city, like the sheer logistics of it are just a nightmare.
Yeah.
But have you witnessed some challenges like that? Are there times where, you know, there's certain areas of the park that have to be kind of limited, or, you know, there's certain stuff going on, or do they keep that mostly, you know, during the off season?
So everyone always asks, you know, what's the easiest way to get to Fenway? And really, there's no parking. That's the problem, because when Fenway was built, you know, back in 1912, you didn't come to Fenway Park in a car. You probably got dropped off in a horse and carriage. So, you know, parking is very limited. You know, spots nearby Fenway, they're going for probably the same price as a grandstand ticket, $50 to $60. You know, we're not one of those newer ballparks that has, you know, plenty of parking for like $10. That just doesn't happen here. So that is definitely a major challenge that Fenway faces. So we always suggest people park out in the suburbs, hop on our public transportation system, the T that we call it up here, and kind of go that way, because there literally is no parking. That's probably our biggest challenge.
Yeah, it's all part of the experience, though.
Yeah, it is.
I noticed that when I was there in June for the first time. We got in an Uber and they were just like, ugh. Like when they figured out where we were going.
Yep.
And yeah. We were like a mile away and we were just like, don't worry about it. We'll just hop out and walk. But like, we didn't know that. So yeah, it was just funny how they were so like annoyed. They were like, yeah, we're not going to drive you all the way
there. Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, our next question actually comes from a person in the audience that we have tonight. She's a professional umpire, and she also, if you'll remember the little pause that we had during your tour when you were giving the wall of fame or whatever on the musicians that have been there. So she used in her, like, prior to being a professional umpire, she opened for Billy Joel. So when you said Billy Joel was there, I was like, oh my gosh, like, So I tried to interject there, but I didn't realize I was like, had to be in the studio to like on screen to be able to talk. But anyway, she has umpired there quite a few times. She says amateur men's and women's baseball. And she would like to know if you are aware if there are separate locker rooms for, because it sounded like there weren't really accommodations for like a female umpire versus a male umpire. So she wanted to know if you're aware of there being gender specific locker rooms for umpires.
I know we have one main locker room for umpires that's located right across from the visitors locker room. It is a very newly renovated space, very updated, has facilities for the umpires to get ready. I'm not 100% sure if we would have a separate locker room just for female umpires, but the Red Sox are very accommodating with an idea like that. So I'm sure they would find a place to make female umpires a lot more comfortable if that need arose.
Yeah, we just need to give them a reason to. That's
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We have another good question from Eric, who wants to know, out of all the moments you've witnessed at Fenway Park, clearly there's been a lot, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I have a favorite. So one of the perks of this job is obviously we get to go to a lot of games, and I was able to go to game one of the 2018 World Series against the Dodgers. And I took my college roommate at that time, and we were sitting out in the bleachers, and that was my first ever World Series game. And Eduardo Nunez hit a go-ahead home run, two-run home run in the seventh inning, I believe. And I'd never experienced the energy and the noise that that moment produced. It's something that I'm always going to remember. So that's probably my favorite moment that I've experienced at Fenway.
Have you gotten to be on the Green Monster during a game?
That's actually one thing I have yet to do. I've been up there hundreds of times with tours, but I've yet to see a game up there. I know me and a couple of friends were looking to do maybe just do standing room tickets, because that's all we can afford. But yeah, it's something I've yet to knock off my bucket list.
We got to start a GoFundMe for you, or John Henry, if you're listening. We got to get Matt Delaney up on that green monster, because I want to go get up there, but you definitely deserve to.
There should be a donation box at the end of your tour. Like, how great was I? Like, how much donation my fund here?
My green monster fund.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions.
Yeah, we got a couple more.
Kelsey, do you have some questions as well?
Go for it. We got a couple more that I'll circle back to in the chat if you want to ask yours.
Okay. So did the wave or did the wave not originate at Fenway Park?
Ooh, that is a good question that I actually don't really know the answer to.
Does anybody? I mean, I feel like it's kind of a myth. Like,
But I actually do have a funny story to that. My dad, who's actually watching the stream, he is a very anti wave guy. He hates
too,
the wave
Dad.
With a permanent passion.
You found
your I actually took him to game one against the Yankees in 2018, the ALDS, and we're sitting out in the bleachers and we started the wave. And my dad's like, "What are we doing? It's the playoffs." And then a guy a couple rows down from us stood up and said, "It's the playoffs. We're not doing the," and then he insert explicitive wave, and my dad literally stood up and applauded that guy. So my dad's not a fan of the wave.
Agreed. Well, the myth is that the seats were built so closely together there that when one had to stand up to get a beer, everyone had to stand up in unison to, you know, get out of the way. And so that is the myth that the Red Sox started the wave.
I haven't heard about that.
We won't blame it on them.
Yeah.
Well, we've got another question, or a couple more questions in the chat. I figure you had to have some kind of extensive training to be as well versed at this as you are. But did you have to study or take a test, or like how do you become a Fenway tour guide?
Great question. So, how I got this job. So I'm a teacher, my full time job. And when I was in grad school, I was actually looking for something to do, you know, on the side. And I just happened to be on Facebook one day and I was following the Red Sox and they had an advertisement for a game day staff for the upcoming 2018 season. So I was just like, hey, you know, let's see if there's something there. I love Fenway, love the Red Sox. Looked through the available jobs and I saw a tour guide. I'm like, oh, that could be fun. Filled out an application, did an interview. And then a couple weeks later, I had went to Fenway for an in-person interview, and then got the job and haven't looked back. And the really cool thing about being a tour guide at Fenway Park is, you know, obviously there are certain areas that we have to hit. You know, obviously we have to talk about the Green Monster. Obviously we have to talk about the Red Seat. But we, as tour guides, you know, we like to make our tour guides, you know, our tours unique to our experiences with Fenway. So, you know, we have a lot of the older tour guides, you know, they'll focus more about the 76 World Series where Fisk is waving his arms around that foul pole, 75 World Series, excuse me, or, you know, the earlier teams performance back in the 80s and 90s where, you know, for me, I love to bring in stuff that happened in the 2000s, you know, when I was going to Fenway Park, you know, what I can relate. So, you know, when we get hired, you know, we're generally thrown onto a lot of tours just to see, you know, hey, here's what, you know, this person does, here's what that person does. And you kind of pick items from different people's tours and you kind of make it your own. So that's a cool thing. You know, if you come back to Fenway Park, yeah, you might hear the same facts, but you're probably going to get a whole different experience from someone else's tour.
That's awesome. Yeah. If you've done it already, do it again.
Yeah.
And that makes sense too. Like you can tell it's so authentic to you because it is as much your story as it is Fenway's story. That's really neat. And honestly, if you can get up and talk in front of junior high kids, no wonder you're so good at this. Cause man, as a middle school teacher, you can probably do anything.
Yeah.
Jessica has a good question for you too. Matt, where is your favorite place in Fenway Park?
My favorite place. Now I get asked this question a lot by fans is where's your favorite place to sit? And I'm a bleacher creature. I love sitting out in the bleachers. There's something about the people out there, the atmosphere. There's nothing like sitting in the bleachers on a warm summer night watching the Red Sox play. So that's probably my favorite place to sit. But my favorite like place in the ballpark as a whole would probably be our left field State Street Pavilion level. And that, if you just Google that, you'll be able to see a beautiful image of the Boston skyline. And from like up there, you can really see how, you know, we're a city ballpark. You know, we're right in the heart of Boston. We're just like Wrigley Field, right in the heart of Chicago. You know, we're not a newer ballpark built out in the suburbs. So those are probably my two favorite areas of the ballpark.
Did you just say you're a bleacher? You like, you're a bleacher creature?
Oh, did I take that from the Yankees? Yeah, I did.
I just had to give you crap about it, but I have another question. If I can jump in. So is it true that there are players' signatures like down underneath the Green Monster?
Yep.
Oh yeah.
And if so, like, who's your favorite that you've seen, or like, I mean, what are some of your favorites that you've noticed?
So it's a tradition. Your first time at Fenway Park as a player, you get to go inside the Green Monster and sign your name on the cement wall. And if you go in there, you can just see names from over 60 plus years of players, you know, all the great players that have played at Fenway Park, you know, Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire, Mike Trout, Alex Rodriguez, Derek Jeter, Tony Gwynn, you know, just to name a few. They've all signed the Green Monster. Myself have also signed, you know, the Green Monster. I was able to do it because, you know, not a player, but I'm still working for the team. My favorite signature up there, honestly, actually has a Yankee connection. Alex Rodriguez's signature is right next to my signature inside the wall, believe it or not.
And that is actually too cool.
And it actually made ESPN Baseball Tonight, like the video of him signing. Yeah. I'm like, hey, there's my name right there.
That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that, because I remember seeing last season, I think it was Lars Nootbaar and Jordan Montgomery, actually, who on the Cardinals, they were there, and they posted a video of them going inside the Green Monster and signing it, which is just such – there's so many cool things that are a rich part of the tradition of it, but
yeah,
that's another one that even means something to the players.
Yeah, and the Royals are in town this week, and the Royals have a lot of first-timers at Fenway. So yesterday, right around like 3 o'clock, we saw about like 8 or 10 Royals players make their way out to the Green Monster. It was unlocked, and they went in and knew exactly what they were doing. They were putting their names up on the legends on that wall.
That's so cool. That's got to be like, you know, like a signature moment in your life where you're like, excuse the pun, but where you're like, I've made it.
Signed
my name at Fenway.
Oh, for sure.
It's definitely a highlight.
Well, Matt, I'll wait until I come to Fenway in person to make you sing Sweet Caroline with me, but hopefully we can do that together. Do you enjoy that part of the game, or are you just kind of over
it? I like Sweet Caroline. I actually have a love-hate relationship with Sweet Caroline. Sweet Caroline's awesome when the Red Sox are winning, but I was actually at the game Sunday, and the Red Sox were losing pretty bad to the Blue Jays, 13-1, and Sweet Caroline came on. And it doesn't have the same feel as, you know, when the Red Sox are winning than when the Red Sox are losing.
That's a really good point. John, you feel that way because they play New York at the end of every Yankees game, right? Regardless of if they win or lose. So,
yeah, that's painful. That's really painful this year.
That's actually part of why I hate the Wave. That's like what I have against the Wave, because I feel like it only happens when, like, it's not always the home team necessarily, but it happens when there's like a blowout game and people aren't necessarily paying attention. And if it happens during a close game, it's even more annoying because you're like, I'm trying to watch what's happening.
Yeah.
So either way, I just can't really get on board. See, we all have more in common than we know. Here we are bringing fans of all fan bases together.
Yes. Well, Matt, I don't want to take, you know, your whole evening from you, but you were fantastic. Just as I expected you would be. To our listeners, if you visit Fenway and visit in the summertime, so you can catch Matt when he's not teaching, and he's likely there at Fenway. He's amazing. Thank you so much for your time and your wealth of knowledge. And as for the rest of you, we'll be back with you soon. Let us know how we're doing at Babes Babes Podcast on Instagram, at Babes Babes Pod on X, formerly known as Twitter. We are not on X now.
What's ahead?
And we are also now on Facebook. So look us up, give us your feedback, your thoughts, and thanks for joining us. We'll see you all next time.
Thanks for having me.